Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Sundays with the Modern. To those of you who are unfamiliar with the program, and I don't think any of you are, each Sunday, we, with some exceptions for holidays and the like, we invite prominent local artists, curators, art historians, architects, and others to give us their thoughts on works on view. Next week, we welcome artist Robert Lazzarini. He's the second in our Focus exhibition series for emerging artists. Mr. Lazzarini will speak on his own work. And additional details about further speakers in this series are available at themodern.org. Today, however, we welcome Dallas-based freelance writer Charles D. Mitchell. D. Mitchell fits into most of the categories I just mentioned, except that he is not... He's assisted in designing a house, but is not actually an architect. He's curated exhibitions, written catalog essays, book reviews, and articles for a wide range of periodicals, including Art in America, The Dallas Morning News, and Glass Tire. He's a cultural omnivore, writing about culture high and low. And you can check out his blog at potatoweather.blogspot.com. It's a test on whether or not you can spell potato. D. Mitchell.
Thank you. The everyone seems so far away. And you know, I've got to mention it. It's strange having so many of you be docents, because I feel like you're going to know more, or you can correct me on dates and things, if nothing else, as we go through this. But I was going to talk about, you know, this museum being the museum that I really grew up with. Not this building, but from the other building. I know that at some point in elementary school, we were all loaded on a bus. This would be in the 50s. We were loaded on a bus and taken to the museum, and all I remember is that Bror Utter showed us how to paint a painting. That's the one. And I don't think I went with my family to go to the museum. I didn't go again until I had a car, or, you know, at least I was driving in high school, and this museum bought the Picasso painting, and it was such a big deal. And, you know, it was on the news, it was in the paper, and I remember coming out to see that, and that actually in 60. That started taking myself and friends to the museum. And also I think that purchase of the Picasso sort of very directly leads to this building and what we have today. That was that signal moment when this museum announced to the world, you know, what they wanted to do. The nature of the collection is, you know, it's a museum of modern art, but that term tends to be flexible with people because, of course, in New York, the Museum of Modern Art starts with Impressionism or Manet. This is truly more a museum of post-World War II art, which is great because, of course, we already, Kimball takes care of earlier things. And the Amon Carter carries, you know, strictly American material. So this is the International Museum of War Contemporary Art, but modern art sounds better in a title. But over 40 years, I mean, when you're in a being in any kind of 40-year relationship, there's ups and downs, or there's moments that, you know, you want to really applaud or, you know, get excited, and there's other times when I just shake my head. I'll quit saying you and go ahead and start saying I. Where I see selections or choices, I just shake my head and think, why on earth would they spend that kind of money on that? But that's, you know, that's what having a museum, you know, in your life for that long should really be about, is that you argue with it, you applaud it, you know, you actually have an ongoing relationship. So we are going to walk through, but I wanted to also emphasize that I would. They asked me if I wanted to do questions at the end, and I would just as soon do nothing but answer questions. I do not have a care. I have, like, things we're going to go to. I have no idea if it's going to take 20 minutes or, you know, an hour. I would truly just as soon stand here and answer questions. So at any point, you know, if I pass by something you have a question about, or if I cease making sense, or if at any point, just feel free to come up with a question. So let's go and let's start looking.
Okay.
The talking about the Picasso and the fact that that was such a big moment. It's interesting that it's not up. And I don't know when I last saw it, actually. But and there is a William Basiotti's painting up, which if you think strictly in terms of art history, why is there a William Basiotti's painting up if you could have a Picasso the same size? But all of these installations or permanent collections are about telling some kind of story. And this museum is very much about telling the story of post-World War II art. The Picasso is from 1960, so it's post-World War II. But, of course, his career began so much earlier. So what really is hitting this museum are things that sort of started in the maybe the late 30s into the 40s and the 50s and on to the present day. And that's why William Basiotti's, who is sort of a surprise to see in a museum, because I associate him with those artists who were around in the 50s, like Theodore Stamos, and who had careers, and but had more or less fallen off the... What do you fall off of? they're not discussed very much anymore. This is a great-looking William Basiotti's painting, and it's definitely about what these two rooms, these first two rooms, were about, because this is definitely the New York... it's the New York School, if you don't look too far to your right, or my right, right here. So it's all about context. And the Basiotti's, sort of helps you see that period, I think, in a way that, of course you could show a lot of things, but if you have a Basiotti's, it really helps you sort of see that period to know what people liked at the time, what the enthusiasms were, what the bigger names that are also in this room, when they were working, what they were surrounded by, and what was just part of that scene. And Basiotti's was definitely part of that scene. The over here, this wall is, this I remember from when I first started coming to the museum, or when was it purchased, let me make sure, 70. This was always one of my favorite paintings when I first started coming to the museum. It's still a favorite painting. But this wall to me, when I was looking at it yesterday, was really interesting because here's the Rothko in the middle. It's a peak period Rothko. It's red. And it's on this side, there's a Ben Shahn painting. And on that side, there's such an early Ad Reinhardt painting that you would be hard-pressed to know it was Ad Reinhardt. Unless somebody had told you, or unless you just really followed that sort of thing. But again, it's of course, it also reflects what the museum has to show. But it's interesting because the Ben Shahn painting, he's an earlier artist, although I think he lived into maybe to 1970. And I did not realize that in the 50s he was one of the most popular artists in America. And I always think of him more as a graphic artist than as a photographer, although maybe the photographs were not even, when he took the photographs, he maybe didn't even think of showing them, that they were sort of found later. And either Franz Klein or Willem de Kooning chose him to represent the United States at the Venice Biennale in 1954, which I found really interesting. Too, that that somebody from such a totally different, well, a different generation, a totally different approach to art would have chosen him to represent the United States in 1954. The one thing, when I was looking at this today, the one thing I found I really like about this painting are these white lines here. And it's very much, I think of him more as a graphic artist than as a painter, and this is very much, this is tempera. But it's handled, it seems, very much like a print. And especially those white lines, that the closer you get, they have no relationship to that figure whatsoever. They sort of define the figure, but they're floating on a different plane than the figure. Especially this one eye is just sort of floating off the face. And it's very much like a graphic technique rather than a painting technique on it. And the Ad Reinhardt... of course, he eventually will be known for, in his lifetime, he would be known for black-on-black abstractions, those beautiful black canvases that people walk by because they think it's solid black. But there's actually a cross shape, or there's always something there. This is I'm not sure what the date is on it, but it's very early, obviously. And you sort of can't imagine how he's going to get from that. I don't know the career well enough. But how do you get from that to painting black on black abstractions just a couple of decades later? It's an interesting painting. If it wasn't by Ad Reinhardt, I don't think it would be particularly interesting. because it is the sort of thing that people wanted to do. But being Ad Reinhardt in this context, it helps to really tell the story of if you sort of know where things are heading, this really helps to tell the story of where things began. Especially all his work with the Baziotis too, and the incredible 1938 Jackson Pollock over here. They were all responding to surrealism and trying to put surrealism behind them. That was the effort, was to get beyond surrealism. And so Baziotis, you can see, sort of stayed with that surrealist, although pretty content-free, stayed with that surrealist mode. Jackson Pollock certainly, as we all know, got far beyond that into a kind of pure painting that they were all striving for. Let's go in here. You might want to ask a question. Yes. Okay.
Mm-hmm. The role of the organization changed dramatically between when it
was. Yes.
Can you tell us how those roles changed?
Well, I think if you go upstairs, there are some of those first paintings that the Fort Worth Art Museum owned. And there's an Innes painting. I'm not even sure who else is there. But it became a museum of modern art. Specifically, it entered the international discourse on modern art by buying those Picassos. They also bought the Vollard suite and something else, I think. But that's the focus. And also, you don't come here expecting to see brand new art, although in the focus exhibitions you do. But the purchases and the acquisitions are very much focused on filling out that story, and really contemporary things, I think, are very carefully, I'm sure all museums say they're very carefully selected, but I think they're very carefully selected to see, not to limit things that would only fit into this narrative they already have going, but to make sure that things stay at that level. Does that at all answer what you're saying?
No, the role of this
Well, I think in 68, when the Tiller Fund became available, and they're really...
My take on it is, your relationship with the Four Other and the Four First School, and the fact that this organization is a center for the local artists to express themselves and teach and have a relationship, did it change at that time?
I think it started moving away. Of course, this program on Sunday afternoon is an example of involving local artists and things. But again, I think it's not a museum of local art. If there's local art here, it's because it's part of the international discourse that's surrounding contemporary art or modern art. I was going to talk about the Philip Guston. He was a card-carrying abstract expressionist for early part of his career, and he did a kind of very brushy, very lovely gray and pinks and reds, and purely non-objective. And then something began to change. Today, it would be hard to imagine the really kind of sense of outrage that went through the New York art world whenever he suddenly was painting pictures of shoes or pictures of Ku Klux Klan members smoking cigars and things, very much in still the same, you know, kind of way. But people thought that he'd either, you know, gone insane or also was betraying everything that they were trying to do as an art movement. And this quote from Guston from 1960 is pretty amazing. There is something ridiculous and miserly in the myth that we inherit from abstract art, that painting is autonomous, pure, and for itself. Painting is impure. It is the adjustment of impurities which focus painting's continuity. We are image makers and image ridden. That would have come as a surprise to to someone like Mark Rothko. But really he sort of disappeared for a while. People didn't, you know, there was no response to those first shows, or a negative response to those first shows of figurative painting. This is definitely a transitional painting. He's moving away from just the abstraction of the depth or the sort of mistiness of the abstraction. It's called the light, which is curious because I guess maybe that pink in the background is the light, or maybe those are three lights, or maybe they're three heads. But it calls much more into question. And as it turns out, Philip Guston was right. He's like the prophet who had no honor in his own country or something. That the direction painting went from there on, whereas so many of the abstract expressionists and New York school painters would have felt under siege by pop art, Guston is the one that sort of saw the direction things are going, and that was where he realized that was where he wanted to go too. That, as he says, there's something ridiculous about the myth that we inherit from abstract art. And we'll see something in the other room too, that people have continued to paint happily, you know, of course, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years, but the crisis has actually hit abstract art more than people, you know, ever since the 60s, people have been painting things in a variety of styles, and it's all been considered valid. The people who really have to explain themselves are the abstract artists. Is how do you justify doing an abstract painting? We'll see some of those in there, one of those in there. But Guston is, what is the date on this, 60-something? 64. It was sort of right after this that the paintings of the shoes started showing up. And that sort of brought things to an end for a while for him, as far as his career was concerned. This is the one California interloper. Clifford Still, famous for being one of the most difficult human beings ever to deal with. This painting, again, you know, it looks kind of like a peeling wall, but it's definitely an abstraction. And I've always liked, also, the closer you get to this painting, there's just like a whole lot of painting going on there. It's really beautifully done. You can tell he's really working on it and getting a spectacular effect. And something always bothered me about this painting, that this is something else that was in the museum from the time I was in high school. Something always bothered me about this painting, and it's that little bit of blue right there. I just can't stand it. And it's because it obviously had to be put there. And this immense composition, just like that little bit of orange on the red, but that it really is a very composed painting. It doesn't invite you in the way that a Rothko would, or you know, it's still, you know, sort of, it's sort of a wall, but it's a very composed painting. And when we get in the other room, something will maybe bring that more into focus for you. Any questions? Yes. Well, it definitely still has the push-pull of the color about it. That could read as a whole. If you're thinking in terms of a wall, that would read as the hole in it. The what? A cliff. Yes. Yeah. Oh, really? He always wanted them shown in groups. And definitely, like, when you go to the Metropolitan and you see a gallery this size with nothing but Clifford Still paintings, and I think everyone becomes a believer, you know, at that point, because they look so spectacular together. Now we're going to go to the Pop Art Gallery. So don't look at anything in here, because we're coming back here. I need one of those little flags. If things were arranged strictly chronologically, gallery to gallery to gallery, this would be the next gallery after the New York School Gallery. But I have competition over there. But pop art, you know, if you mentioned pop art to Americans and the way that we all thought about it, it would be Andy Warhol, Robert Lichtenstein, and just like upstairs, the Klaus Oldenburg, the big droopy tube of toothpaste. And with Rauschenberg and Johns being kind of an uneasy fit into that mix. And it was really considered an American phenomenon by Americans. Europeans always wondered why Americans always thought that they came up with everything. Because there was no small amount of, you know, the same changes were happening everywhere. And that's one thing, again, talking about the international aspect of this museum. This is a very international room of pop art. In fact, in the other gallery on that side, there's the very early David Hockney painting that could just as easily be in here. But it gets away from that interpretation where if you see pop art, you just see those four or five American names. You also sort of can no longer call things paintings necessarily. I was about to say this Viollet painting, but it's framed and it's on the wall, but it's not a painting. It's this sort of he and Raymond Hahn, who they also have a piece by that's not up right now. They started out taking photographs around Paris of the destroyed advertising hoardings and things where, you know, things would peel off and so forth. And finally, they decided just to cut some off and start doing it themselves. So I don't think, not necessarily any of these are exactly as they were found. They all look as though they were found, but they were definitely working on them at the time. But it gets so far away. I mean, immediately you're so far away from that New York School purity of painting idea. It's not even like the purity of figure painting. It is truly just ripping up the posters that are on the streets, and also they look great. You know, like, by the, that's if nothing else, one thing that modern art has taught us is to look at everything, you know, and to appreciate, you know, enjoy looking at things. And this Richard Hamilton painting here. Which is a picture of Mick Jagger and, I can't remember his name, but it was Richard Hamilton's art dealer, the night they were arrested for marijuana possession. And this was the shot of them being taken off to the police station. I think it's called Swinging London. Yeah, instead of Swinging London, which was the official sort of nomenclature for London in the 60s. This is swinging London, which I assume has whinging as part of it because they're kind of whinging there against the glare. But it's very hard to think that this picture, when you think of like the ambition to paint, to create the timeless work of art, and to be working for, to be really, working towards posterity, it's very hard to think that this picture of Mick Jagger and his art dealer getting busted for marijuana has anything to do with that. And works of art are always simultaneously sort of timeless works of art, but they're also artifacts of their time. And that second aspect, people became much more comfortable in the 60s with emphasizing the second aspect of it. And also this is not a multiple, but there are various versions of it, because that's not uncommon from the Renaissance on, that people keep painting, or the studio produces other versions of things. But it's such a great moment in history, but you do wonder like how quickly or when people are going to need more and more explanation to know what this painting, who these people are. Like, I've already forgotten the name of the art dealer. When they don't recognize anybody. And that's sort of the, that's what happens with, of course, when you look at Renaissance paintings, you have to read who the people are. because we don't, the original audience knew who the Duke of so-and-so was. But you have to read about it now. And this sort of, so it does have a tradition, but it emphasizes that artifact aspect of things. And John Chamberlain, I can always, if anybody asks me who my least favorite artists are, I can always say Jim Dine and John Chamberlain. It's convenient to have somebody right off the top of the head you can explain. But I never quite got John Chamberlain's sculptures because they were always, in fact, his label says this too, that they were associated with abstract expressionism. And that it was a way to make a sculpture that was abstract, that was like an abstract expressionist painting. And I never liked the way they looked, for one thing. And also they often look like Fritz Schoelder Indians to me, if you know those prints of Indians going like this. When they're 6 feet tall, they almost all look like that. But to see this piece moved into this gallery with pop art, which is contemporaneous. Actually, it's even late. I think it's from the 70s. But to see it put in a pop art context, it makes perfect sense all of a sudden. I mean, it is a New York taxi cab, I assume. But to not have to think about it in that realm of exalted aspiration of the New York school and the spiritual aspirations of so many of those paintings, but to see it plunked down here in pop art, it has a whole different resonance for me, and just that the context provides. I like it here. Let's go in here. This would normally be, I would always say that this is my room, because whenever I first really started looking at art, it was, I guess what I was seeing was conceptually reading about conceptual art, and seeing things. Having said that, I'll say that Lawrence Weiner is one artist I never get it. And why is, and he always says these are sculptures. I know one, I was on a panel with Lawrence Weiner one night, and so I'd read up on him, and if you read like his interviews and what people write about him, and then hear him talking, you go, oh, I get it. But I swear the next day I was going, now why are they sculptures again? But they look good. But this is the what instantly became my favorite painting. Is this Bryce Marden painting? That when the first time I walked in and saw it, and I guess I'd read about Bryce Marden. But when I walked in and actually saw it at the museum, it was like right when you came into the left. It made such perfect sense to me that this is a truly beautiful painting. And remember what I said about being bothered by the little blue bit on the Clifford Still painting. Well, all of this right here is what, it just happens. It's part of the process of making that painting that you have that ragged edge. There's a ragged edge down here too, but you don't see it so much because it's two shades of gray, very close together, two shades of gray. But instead of being the, instead of composing that picture the way Clifford Still did and putting that little touch of blue in the upper left to sort of, you know, accent in some way, suddenly paintings were just about what happened as you made them. And also, I mean, obviously he knew it looked good that way, that it would not look as good if the gray was on top. But I just never quite, as soon as I saw this, like art began to really interest me again and just make sense in a way. And the Carl Andre here on the floor is... I guess also to say that I never have quite gotten Lawrence Wiener, but to see Carl Andre to read about the importance of the floor, that always made perfect sense to me. That's what this is about, is the floor, and it's industrial materials. You know, he hasn't touched, or he ordered them a particular size. I don't know if these have numbers under them, as far as how you spread them out, or if you can just, you know, arrange them any way you want to. But it's totally, it's almost invisible, but also it's incredibly obtrusive, if you think about it, because it takes up so much space. And of course, you know, you're told that you can walk on it, but there's no big signs up saying, please walk on this, because there's no point in having, you know, the museum crowd walk on it all the time. But he did say that, you know, you can just walk on them. What else was I going to say about him? But this is just the moment when all that sort of nerdiness, in a way, of post minimal art, and although I guess Carl Andre would be in with minimalism, I think it's because of when I started looking and the times in the 70s, the late 70s, it was what was in the air, and it did just make sense. It just made sense to me. Bruce Nauman walking back and forth in his studio while the video camera's on. I got it. Those funny Eva Hess lumps of stuff, or they used to have it up in here, the Linda Binglis mound of stuff piled in the corner, which I think is called Far Carl Andre. Which I've never known if that was like if they were fighting over something or, you know, because it's the most non-Carl Andre piece of work you could possibly imagine. But that was the period that I sort of really started paying attention and just loved it all. And never understood why some people, you know, would say that they that it wasn't art or that it just didn't look like art to them. Carl Andre had a famous incident where he was commissioned to do a public sculpture in Maine, which I think was his home state, and he got three or four boulders of the local rock and put them in front of the building, and maybe they're still mad about it. but it's like, you know, it seemed just right to me. I do, on the other hand, I know that that's not art. That piece of plastic hanging there, not only because of the context, but also it just wouldn't be very good if it was art. But the real surprise, it turns out, is that Dan Flavin, according to the European Union, is no longer an artist. Have you, I don't know if you've read that in the paper or anything, but it's a tax issue because... the European Union, or whoever is in charge of taxation at the European Union, said that that these were hardware, that they were not art, and that they were subject to full VAT, which is, you know, considerable. If it would be $1 million, that's $380,000 tax instead of the $150,000 you would be paying on art. It's bound to be overturned eventually. But it's something that you think is so far behind society, or you, if it happened, you would think it was going to happen in, you know, Pittsburgh or Kansas City or someplace. But this is actually the European Union. So, and they singled out Dan Flavin and Bill Viola, that the videotapes were not art, that they were just videotapes. And so even so, if you paid $300,000 for it or $400,000 for it, you had to pay full VAT instead of like buying. No, they're basing the VAT on the market value, but they're saying it's not art. So if you pay $1 million for this, they want to tax it as though you've bought a piece of hardware.
They don't tax it as though
you bought the hardware. Well, you know, see, it's bound to be turned overthrown. You know, yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. But it has happened.
Interesting to see this is what attracted you.
Yeah.
And can you give us some link of why it speaks to you?
Well, I think one thing is that it answered why the Clifford Still painting had always bothered me. That what I objected to in that was that little blue mark that was part of a, no matter what it looked like, it was still part of a careful composition or a totally thought out composition. This is the result of a process, and it's beautifully done. It's I can't think of what you call it. It's the wax and oil impregnated in encaustic, but everything about it is just a result of spreading that encaustic over the canvas. It's an abstract. It can be, unless you want to read that as a horizon line, which it sort of unavoidably is. You know, like anywhere in the Western world, at least, a line going straight across the middle of something becomes an horizon of some sort. But the colors have essentially the same. Neither one of them pulls back or juts forward from the other one. So it's very. It's just unlike the painting like the Mark Rothko that really wants you to come into it. This basically says just stay out, but it offers you so much to look at. At the same time, Robert Mangold, I had this discussion a long time ago about Robert Mangold for something I was writing for the paper, but somebody was wondering like why Robert Mangold, like couldn't just anybody do that, and of course they didn't do it is the main thing, but I always, you know, especially something as simple as this, is what Robert Mangold does with the geometry is he just creates something that wouldn't be there any other way. If that makes sense. Like dividing that, if that was one solid piece of just that color canvas or whatever, maybe it's on board, dividing in half like that creates just something that wouldn't have been, you know, it wouldn't have been there. Now often, that's very austere for Robert Mangold. And contemporary Robert Mangold's are much more complex and much more inviting. But this is like a classic minimalist Robert Mangold. You know, how do you be a minimalist and still make something that's like a painting? Although the question will also come up is it a painting or does it become an object? And is it a sculpture, basically, or a wall relief? Because it seems to offer you so little of what a painting would normally offer. So let's go back to this big room.
The kids.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm sure.
You were saying.
I was I had a kid walk up to me in half-price books one day with a book open to a picture of John Lennon. And he said, "Is this one George?" And then he went, "Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were my father." Everybody's really far away again. The one thought about, yes? I think an emotional involvement with it, an invitation into the picture, where there's a Renaissance window, you know, like Renaissance paintings are considered windows, landscape paintings are certainly panoramic views of landscapes you can imagine stepping into. Those really just don't offer you that. They just sit there on the wall as a thing, and you have to come to grips with the way that it's presented and decide whether or not you like it. And I think they're definitely, certainly Bryce Martin is a painter. And he's making paintings, and what he makes now are much more painterly than that. But again, sort of like seeing the early Ad Reinhardt, that you wonder how on earth do you get from that to going to severe black-on-black abstractions. It's almost the reverse with Bryce Martin, is how do you get from doing these severe monochromatic and caustic paintings to doing the absolutely luscious paintings that he's doing now? But again, like, you know, that's why you have retrospectives, I guess, because you lay it all out and you can really see what's happening. One of my first thoughts about doing this was that I would, if I was really good, that I would just stand here for an hour and talk about these three paintings. That, it doesn't get better than this. The one time I was supposed to give something similar to this at the Dallas Museum, the day before they asked me what I was going to talk about, and I said, well, mostly I'm going to talk about the Ellsworth Kelly Red painting. They said, it's down. somebody had bumped into it the week before or something, and they took it down for restoration. But again, these are from 86 and bought in 86. Another thing about the Bryce Martin is it's from 1971, and this museum bought that painting in 1971, which is as big a bargain as getting the Picasso for $105,000 in 1967. But the Fort Worth Museum was the first museum to buy a Bryce Martin painting, which I think really speaks to, you know, who was here and the direction they knew it was going and how close of attention they were paying to what was going on in the scene. These Ellsworth Kellys are from 86, and they were bought in 86, too. And, of course, this is an earlier Ellsworth Kelly. But, again, everything about these... everything is so wonderfully off about them. The way that they're... they are three paintings, by the way. It's not a triptych. It's three individual paintings. But, of course, they look great that way. But you sort of say, well, the triangular one. But it's not triangular because it has those weird puffy sides to it. And whatever that would be, if I remember my geometry correctly, it's skewed so. And... you know, the thing about Ellsworth Kelly paintings is that they're usually based on direct observation of some kind of light effect or some kind of natural effect. And so I know people have done exhibitions of, you know, like where he would be taking photographs or looking at magazines or postcards and sort of circling a little area. And that little area, which should be in perspective, turned into an outline, becomes this kind of shape. And I think at the other museum, when these were up at the smaller museum, and it seems like they were in that small gallery where they were that they surrounded you on three sides and went almost floor to ceiling and had a totally different sort of overbearing effect almost. But they have finally found, like, you know, the perfect spot for these paintings. And the fact that they're called red, green, and blue, red, blue, and green. Especially the green is sort of, you know, it's like it might be right out of the tube, you know, if you know your oil paints, but it's certainly not primaries, whereas Ellsworth Kelly dealt with primary colors early on, right off the chromatic scale. These are very, very worked over and very emotional colors in a way. But again, are they paintings or is it a wall relief? And so much of Ellsworth Kelly's work, a lot of them are wall reliefs, or they're called reliefs. And of course, he's also a sculptor. But these are paintings, except they're very much like wall reliefs when you look at them. I said earlier about the crisis in abstract painting, and that Philip Guston got it right when he sort of went figurative, and people have been happily painting figurative paintings ever since then, and. Whereas you have to constantly justify doing an abstract painting. And Frank Holpert once, on a panel, I heard her say that, ask, when was the last time you saw an abstract painting that was not a painting of an abstract painting? And which I think is pretty valid. And I think that room is maybe it. That almost every abstract painting you see now is so self-conscious and so such an effort to deal with the fact that it's an abstract painting that it could be just a painting of an abstract painting. And this is Calamenes. Very contemporary. It's 2000-something, isn't it? But again, his whole, what he's dealing with is being a painting. And so here's this very mask-like appearance that would be white and black. The hard geometry, but he goes in and starts painting it out with some kind of, I'm not sure what he uses, whether it's turpentine or some kind of thinner, but he basically starts painting it out, and suddenly, so over here, you suddenly have this Rothko painting developing, where you're very much invited in, and it all seems like, so that's it, is that all there is to it? But actually, it's not all there is to it, because the black here, when I first saw this painting, I always kind of assumed that this was all wash from painting this out. But of course, it's been painted black all the way to the ground, or all the way to the base here. And so he has controlled it all to such a degree that even though he started up here and it must have been running like mad and making a mess, he was able to control it enough to stop it, or maybe it was as simple as taping it off. And then at the bottom part, actually removing more. It would be hard to do if you were working on it. But I think this is almost every abstract painting you see today is much more along these lines, is that it's constantly asking the question of how can I, how can I still do this? How can I still make an abstract painting? One other piece. Are we good for one other piece? Okay. Let's go out here, if I can find it. It's too big to move. Right the first time? That was right the first time. So what do people ask about this when you take them through as docents? Yeah.
It's like, duh.
Do we just lose everybody else?
And they're so glad when you said, well, you tell me. You get it right.
Yes. Again, I'm not sure what the date is on this. It must be in the 90s at some point. But I think this is the perfect place to end this kind of tour of this collection, because this is the biggest surprise. How did we get here to spilling this candy on the floor from where we were after World War II? And I don't know that any one collection can tell you that, but that, if nothing else, the collection sets you up to ask those kind of questions. Of course, it is candy. You're invited to eat one, but of course, they don't have a sign up telling you to eat one. And I ate one about 10 years ago, and it wasn't very good. But and the instructions on it is nothing but spread it. And I've seen this work installed. This actually isn't my favorite installation of this work. But I've seen it piled in the corner, so it's cascading down. And the Dallas Museum did a really beautiful oval of it that was much, the edges weren't as ragged as this. And then, of course, you have to tell somebody, or people say, well, what's it about, though? Well, it is about something. It's about AIDS. That's what Felix Gonzalez Torres' paintings are. That's what his work was about. He had AIDS. He was an early HIV death. But he, so all of his work was very much about tenderness and losing grasp of things and things being disposable. And so there were stacks of paper that you were invited to take one. Billboards that were black and white images of an unmade bed, which was sort of like, the one thing you should not put out, or the most personal thing, suddenly just throwing it out in public like that. And the candy, too, is about like how beautiful it is as an object, and yet you can just pick it up and eat it. And I do think that this is actually on loan from Howard, but I think basically when people have bought these, you get like an extra pickup load full of candy or something to, so that you don't run out. But, yes? Whoever installs it. The what? The curator. So I do think, that this is, I'm glad this is here, because it is the perfect way, I think, to, you don't get the complete story. It's not a dogmatic story, but there's definitely, you're shown what's happened from 1945 until yesterday. And this is the piece, I think, that really sums that up better than anything.
Thank you, Dave.